nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
My name is Hendrik, and we welcome you to another Red Ice Radio program. We are now into the year 2013, and we are going beyond everything known into the unknown. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com, two of our websites that you should note if you want to follow us on a regular basis. And we cover anything that we consider to be interesting and important. Byron Belitzos is an award-winning publisher who has been editor of many acclaimed books. He is a longtime student of the Urantia book, and he's the co-author of The Adventure of Being Human. We are going to discuss the main cosmology that is presented in the Urantia book today. This book was first published by the Urantia Foundation in 1955, claiming to have been presented by celestial beings as a revelation to our planet, Urantia. We'll talk about the book's instruction on Genesis, the destiny of humanity, and one of the central themes, which is that of the rebellion of Lucifer. Byron will also tell us about the angelic hierarchy and the correcting time, but we'll begin on the origin of this mysterious book. All right, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Byron. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for coming on and talking with us today. Looking forward to this one.
Thanks, Henrik. It's an honor to be on your show.
Excellent. We've wanted to do a program about the Urantia book for quite some time now, and this is one of those topics, I guess, that for some reason it hasn't happened sooner. But again, here we are. We're doing it, and we're, of course, opening up the subject with you today, Byron. So why don't we talk, first of all, about how you got involved in the Urantia book when you first, I guess, heard about it and when you wanted to dedicate some of your time to work with the book and obviously promote the message in it.
It actually began quite a long time ago when I was a student in college at the University of Chicago, when I was studying intellectual history, European history of ideas. And I was really engaged in a lot of questions that I did not find answers to from professors and from books that I was reading. And it was around that time that, just by total coincidence, I ran into somebody who mentioned the Urantia book. And that was really quite early. It was really very much unknown in those days, except in very limited circles in the United States and in France and a few other places. And for whatever reason, it just immediately appealed to me. Intuitively, I knew there was something special about it, and I didn't accept the claim of off-planet pedigree right away. But it really rang truth bells in me, and particularly the parts about history, since I was a student of history, and right away I became a student of those parts of the Urantia book, and then it just progressed from there, and it's been really one of my main hobbies throughout my adult life.
Sounds very interesting. We love talking about history, and we'll get into some of that later, of course. But let's cover some of the basics in the beginning. Some of the questions that are obvious here. First of all, what does Urantia mean?
Yeah, Urantia is the purported name of our planet, according to the rest of the universe. So the off-planet celestial hierarchy and also extraterrestrial visitors use that name or an equivalent of that name in designation for us. So Urantia book refers to the name of the planet Urantia.
And so let's get into who is behind it. We can break this up in two different segments. Of course, the words themselves are written by somebody, but it's also another author or several maybe authors. Break this down for us, Varun.
Yeah, there's numerous supposed celestial beings who are the authors of these papers, and there's 196. They're called papers. They're like large chapters, and the way this the story of how this comes about is goes back to all the way to 1906, when a very small group of people had a kind of channeled celestial contact through a person who we still do not know the name of. This person, the person is anonymous, as many guesses as to who it was, but there was it was sort of an Edgar Casey style contact where the person was completely asleep in deep sleep, and voices would come through this person. And after a period of time, these voices announced that they were to present to these people around this person a very large revelatory text. And a number of years passed as they kind of debriefed these people. They were based in Chicago. These angelic beings began to sort of orient these people to what they wanted to do. And what they had intended to do was to present a very an epical revelation to the planet. And they we now know that there were other locations and other groups that were being cultivated for this purpose. And finally, they chose to, this group seemed to have the right composition, the right location, the right mentality. So the revelation process formally begins in 1924. And at this point, it's a rather different process of not the Edgar Casey style channeling, but the actual appearance or materialization of these papers, these chapters. So,
Who kind of picked the group? Do you think was this a criteria from this group that was, well, maybe not channeled them, but in the Edgar Casey kind of style received? Did they have an outline of who they wanted to give this to? I guess.
You mean that they survey sort of the human groups from above and then select them?
Right, something like that, I guess.
Yeah, they really, what it is when these events transpire in the interactions between the celestial realms and humans, apparently they do massive surveys and they look for the right people that have the stamina and the intelligence to carry it off. And that's also the case with the choice of the parents of Jesus. We get into that later, that they were chosen from among many of the parents in Palestine to be the bearers of Jesus of Nazareth, who is a very, very important figure in the Urantia book. So, but coming back to the Urantia book itself, they identified this group because assembling around, the group actually assembled around a particularly world-class intellectual and leader, a guy named Bill Sadler, who was a professor at University of Chicago. He was a surgeon and a psychiatrist. Just back then, he could be both a surgeon and a psychiatrist. And he was the kind of became the leader of this group over the next 50 years. So really, it was about him and his wife, named Lena Sadler, also a physician, Dr. Lena Sadler, that they identified them as the best people to carry this very difficult, unusual project forward, and they did until their death, both of them, and this large entourage that formed around them of several hundred people over these decades, and that group became the bearers of this revelation.
And they were called the Contact Commission, correct?
Yeah, there's several groups. There's the contact personality, the anonymous person. Then there's the Contact Commission, which is this inner core of people I mentioned earlier. There were really in sort of the classic period of this, there were six people who were the contact personalities that had verbal interactions through the anonymous subject. We call him the sleeping subject. And then around them, in concentric circles around them, was another group called the Forum. And the Forum were just friends and acquaintances and actually patients of Dr. Sadler and his wife, Lena Sadler, that they invited into the secret gatherings where they would present these papers that were materializing. So, you know, let me stop there and let you ask a question.
Okay, sure, definitely. Well, it's very interesting. We want to get into this, of course, and all about the material and everything, but the first copy, I think, of the papers in a book format was first published in 1955, correct?
Yeah, 1955 it was first published, but the book was actually completed some years before that, but they had a lot of proofreading to do, typesetting. But also the Celestials asked them to wait a bit after World War II before they published it for a variety of reasons. So there was a bit of a delay in there. So it the book was really current by the late 40s, current in terms of known human knowledge in the late 40s, and then there was this period of delay until 1955. So that's the big, yeah.
All right. I mean, I know this is a lot about listening to the message, of course, and not about the messenger or getting kind of obsessed about that. But I mean, obviously, we have to ask, who are the celestial beings? Who is this? Where is this message coming from?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a huge question to answer, because the Rancho book presents an unknown, unusual, what you might call angelology. So this celestial hierarchy that they refer to, most of it is terms that are unique to the Rancho book, but many terms that we know from the Bible and from other religions are sort of brought into this and then redefined for us. But many of the terms that are used in current usage in regard to angels are not used in the Urantia book. Some of the terms that are used are words such as seraphim and cherubim, archangels, and other terms that you may not have heard of are, although there is a reference to this in the Old Testament, there's beings called the Ancients of Days. And Ancients of Days are the oldest angelic beings in the universe of universes. And that's why they're called Ancients of Days. And they reside at the center of a galaxy cluster as the chief angelic administrators of a very, very large group of galaxies in these clusters. So those are the beings that originally instigated this revelation. So it's from a very, very high place, from the highest angelic beings, as described in the Urantia book. But it mainly comes through what we call the local universe administration. And the local universe in the Urantia book is a unit of let's say within the celestial hierarchy, it's a unit of 10 million and up to 10 million inhabited planets, which has its own local angelic administration. So we can break that apart if you like.
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
So in the cosmology, I guess the first thing folks would need to get to understand this is that the Urantia book offers a very vastly expanded cosmology from what we now have. For example, the timeline of the time-space universe is much extended to nearly a trillion years old, rather than the current, 13.7 billion years. It's kind of surprising how far the Rancho book extends. And what it says is that there is a central source universe, which is not a created universe. It is always existed. It's eternal. It's kind of like an island. You can picture it as an island hovering in the middle of the universe, but it's outside of space-time. But it's, in a sense, the geographic center of all things. And it's the geographic center of infinity, although that's a sort of a paradoxical notion. It's a metaphor for what this is. And this eternal mother universe is the source of all time-space universes. So there isn't a Big Bang cosmology here, but there's kind of a quasi Big Bang in the sense that these time-space universes, which are galaxies, galactic, are created, they're intentionally created by beings that descend from this mother universe to come into space-time, and then they initiate the actual physical transactions that create galaxies and actually nebula that then cool to become galaxies. And so these are celestial beings, and this does not happen sort of by nature. It happens by intention, by high beings who create the conditions for the evolution of nebulas and then galaxies, and then these galaxies begin to cool, and the suns in these galaxies, as they begin to cool, begin to throw off planets, and the planets cool, and eventually these become peopled over billions and billions of years, and all throughout these different ages of the creation of the time-space universe, there are beings, high celestial beings, who are managing this from the central universe until a certain point when these local these creations have begun to generate enough specificity physically with planets cooling and beginning to become spheres, that they send out beings from the central mother universe who become inhabitants in these local creations. So this is a pretty long-winded way of saying that there are local creation, local universes, as I mentioned previously, which in our case, our local universe is 400 billion years old, and the beings who are the ones that were sent out from the central universe to the local universe are known as Christ, as in Jesus, but with a different name in the Urantia book, and his female divine feminine consort. And those are the most important celestial beings to know about in connection with the Urantia book, because they have become the sort of the local deities of our local universe, which, as I mentioned, has a potential of 10 million inhabited planets. So I'll stop there so you can try to dig into all of that.
Sure. Now, so if we get a little bit closer to this question of why it was written and what the book strives to achieve, it is about trying to give us the truth about our history, our origin, where we come from, how things basically work in the universe. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I just want to tell folks that if you're feeling a little overwhelmed by all the detail I've been providing, you can always just pick up the Urantia book or go to websites and you can see summaries of what I just mentioned. But so the point of this whole exercise and explaining all of this and why we have such a massive, broad presentation in the Urantia book is that what they're trying to kind of what the key message or one of the key messages is that our planet Urantia is one of the rarest planets in the local universe or any universe, because our planet was a planet where there was a massive rebellion of the angelic host on the planet. And so they're coming to help us understand that and the results of that in our history, and to help correct the results of that angelic rebellion as well, and to explain the extraordinary things that were done to try to retrieve the planet from what you might call the dark side. So the reason your Urantia book is difficult, complicated, often overwhelming is that we have a difficult, complicated, and overwhelming history. And so one has to be patient and try to understand this from the standpoint of the celestial beings who are responsible for us. And they're doing quite a job here in providing this huge text, which does, admittedly take, some years to understand.
Indeed, it's over 2,000 pages. There's a lot to read. I haven't read the entire book yet myself. I hope I'll be able to finish it in the next couple of years maybe. But I know the book extends way beyond the Bible and other religious texts as well. But it seems to be also centered a lot around previous messages, previous revelations, if we can call it that. Is it trying to change those or correct those, you know, scriptures like the Bible?
Yeah, it is. It is helping to correct the sort of the folkloric aspect of these previous records. And truly, you know, they are real events that come down in as legends in, you know, all the world's religions, simply because, you know, you don't have an authoritative celestial being who's writing it for you. What you have are humans, charismatic humans, who are recipients of a revelation and then write this down, and it gets lost or it gets adulterated. So yes, a big part of this, and the part that I've always found very interesting, is making, first of all, indicating that there were previous revelations to the planet that are entirely lost, and then correcting other revelations, such as the revelatory events that led to the creation of the Hebrews, that led to Christianity, also even Buddhism and Hinduism and other religions. They give very essential information about other religions and how they were initiated and what happened to them. So yeah, they have a phrase now that they use for this. It's called the correcting time. And we are now in the period from 1955 is the correcting time. That was not announced in the Urantia book. It was announced later, actually in the 1980s, in new transmissions that we haven't spoken about yet, but there's, believe it or not, there's even more information that's come in the last 25 years. And one of the new things they said is, yes, this whole thing is called the correcting time. We're correcting your civilization and getting you on back on course after having been way off course for millennia.
So is this driven by these angelical administrators that you mentioned before?
These newer revelations are the very same administrators, the same authors of the original Urantia text. And after having gotten this into print and gotten this distributed throughout the world and translated into a lot of languages, such as Swedish, by the way, they then returned in a new way, in sort of more traditional, more sort of New Age style channeling sessions, which there's been hundreds, actually thousands of them that we now know of. And those are all transcribed, and this is additional supplemental material to the Urantia book, which is going to take me probably my whole lifetime to get through, and I published five books based on it. Mm-hmm. So these same beings are unfolding more revelation, and really what it is, the Urantia book is, I prefer to call it Urantia Revelation, which is a process of revelation beginning in the early 20th century and still going on. In fact, it was at one of these sessions just a few days ago, hearing new teachings, believe it or not.
Interesting. Is this, by hearing this, I can already feel that this is a controversial area. There's probably different groups out there that are for and against this, and they're already maybe kind of denominations breaking apart of the origin of the book and everything. Is that correct? Just my guess.
Henrik, you have very good intuition. That's exactly what has happened, and I'm in trouble with what we call the mainstream Urantia people, who hold only to the text, to the original printed text, and do not hold to this newer supplemental material. And so, indeed, our group, this correcting time group, it's often called, is considered to be schismatic. But you know, there are no churches or anything of that, or you know, nature connected to the Urantia book. So it's not like there's a breakup of this church. But there's a controversy, and it's a tough one because, you know, if you were if you were a Mormon, say, and after 100 years somebody said, well, now we have an update to the Book of Mormon. That would be pretty tough to handle.
Yeah,
and that happened also with A Course in Miracles. You may know, Henrik, that there were new presentations that came later and caused a split in that community. And you know, I think it's just going to happen because the planet is in a dire crisis, And, you know, these loving beings, and believe me, you know, their whole mission is love and redemption of the planet. They have to be around. We need them. So they've come back and they're updating their teachings. That's what this new mission is. It's an update for, I think of it as an update for the postmodern mind, mm-hmm. whereas the Urantia book more really appeals more to the modernist mindset.
Interesting. Now it's a flavor, of course, of what we resonate with, what sounds right to us, basically. But it's funny to me how certain messages are perceived as being, you know, so-called genuine, quote unquote, from God or from the source, or whatever. And then after a certain period of time, there's an update, if you will, to this, another revelation or a new person is coming out. But then it's a very, and then all of a sudden that message is basically rejected. And it's very strange to me that that it works for some people on a certain basis of it just being simply old, I guess. But if there's a new version of it, then it's rejected for the basis that it's new, basically.
Yeah, it's really an odd thing. And this is part of the problem of Urantia, you might say, is that people, you know, when some new truth comes through, they become attached to it like a dog to a bone, in a way, you know, because we're so desperate, really, to understand our situation. And so, you know, one has to have compassion for the sort of the fundamentalists among us, because, you know, there's a reason for it. There's a need for security and for certainty amid so much chaos. So, you know, I'm not a big critic of fundamentalists for that reason, and I try to be patient, and I probably have fundamentalist streak myself. So it's very much the case in the Urantia community, which is a very tiny community already, that we have this problem. But you know, from my point of view, it's just common sense that if we are loved, if we are cared for, we're going to continue to receive revelation.
Yep, I agree with that. Now, not that this is the most important thing, perhaps, but how is the message being perceived by people who are currently in other religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, etc.? Is it being openly accepted, if you will, or is it rejected pretty much?
It's not even known, it's known to some circles of a sort of Christian leadership, particularly liberal Christians, and also we know the Vatican knows about the Urantia book. But it's not really known because of the difficulty of explaining what this is. You can see that, you know, how overwhelming it is as I explain it to you, all these new terms and this expanded cosmology, you know, and how do you explain that to somebody who's, you know, steeped in Christian theology for their entire life, and now you've got some new, a whole new Bible. So, you know, they really, and I've attempted this myself. I was in a theological school at University of California at Berkeley and wanted to write a dissertation on the Urantia book, and it just didn't compute with those people. There was just no way, you know, and I really put all the attention and all the time that I could possibly do into it, and I just really made no headway. And others have tried it and have not made headway. And that's with academics in theology. But in the world's religions, it's not well known and won't be for a long time. It's going to be something which is more underground and more of a grassroots phenomenon, which indeed it is.
Indeed. Now, is this in any regard trying to, again, this might not be the purpose of it, but this happens nonetheless. Is it in the process of creating a new religion, or is it just, as you said before, kind of working very well with the current New Age community?
You know, it's odd that it's not even working with the New Age community. because I'm actually known as a New Age publisher and editor, and my experience of this is that, if number one, New Age folks don't know about its existence, at least in the United States, for the most part. And mm-hmm. secondly, if they do know, they're really not that interested for a variety of reasons, especially because it actually sounds to them a little bit like Orthodox Christianity. Right. Because it states that Jesus, you know, actually was an incarnate deity, and that, you know, some of the precepts of Orthodox Christianity, it actually affirms and expands them. So that's really not something New Age folks are interested in. And they're in rebellion against the Christian tradition for the most part. Or if they're sort of unity church, I don't know how well you know about the New Thought people. It's too specific for them. It's too, New Thought tends to prefer, philosophic ideas and not specifics about history and cosmology, and it's just not their bailiwick. Let's go back to your original question if you want to restate that.
Yeah, what did I ask again? I think I asked basically about, well, actually, let me ask this first. Let me move on here a little bit. If it's been around since 1955, and any religion, again, maybe you don't want to see it this way, but if there is a creation of a new ideas, new thought, etc., and in a way a new religion, it always takes a lot of time, of course. But let's say 1955, publishing of it, why do you think it's not more popular today? Why has it not caught on more in the mainstream?
My view of that is it's pretty elaborate, and that's because I was around since 1974. I happened to be in the city of its origin in Chicago as a student at the University of Chicago, so I got to meet some of the original people at the headquarters of the Urantia Foundation. And what I found was that they had a split in the regard to the sort of the marketing and advertising of this. There was a minority group that wanted to do traditional advertising and marketing. And the majority group, their view was that we should be word of mouth. It's sort of like Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be by attraction, not by promotion. Mm-hmm. And so that group won out. However, the problem with that group is that they were fairly isolated, and they were elderly, and they were they had experienced so much rejection in the 50s and 60s that they were kind of at a loss of what to do. And by the time I ran into them in the 70s, they didn't really have a plan. They were just like, what do we do now? And the younger group that I was part of were questioning and saying, well, what do we do? And so that group is the group that worked this out. And they very slowly came around to basically what I'm doing, which is publishing secondary works about it, setting up some advertising and getting people out to speak about it and that sort of thing. But it's been very slow. And I also got to tell you, Henrik, that I have my own personal conspiracy theory about this.
Sure. Well, tell us. I'd like to hear it.
It's just mine and it's nobody else's. And it's, I've been around quite a long time and I've engaged in with the field of deep politics and published books in that field. And in fact, I helped put on a major conference on deep politics in 2008. And I'm very conversant with it. And I really think that the Urantia book has been actively suppressed in high places. I don't have sort of smoking gun evidence, but I have circumstantial evidence of it. And we're talking about just throughout the media, in publishing circles, in seminaries. I think there's been an active, conscious suppression. And I think that emanates from the groups that the Urantia book is describing when it describes the prehistory going back to its satanic roots. And in the Urantia book, in more than anywhere I've ever seen, is a clear and clean description of who these bloodlines are, how they originated, and how they operated. And so it's describing who they are and who their chief celestial was that they worshipped, Lucifer, and presents that in such a way that it's unmistakable who this is, what this is. And I think those are the groups behind the scenes that were suppressing the Urantia book.
Very interesting. You know what? Let's get into that right now. Let's get into the rebellion of Lucifer, what happened there and what the book says about this, because we want to try to understand, of course, our prehistory to try to unravel some of the issues that we are faced with today. What does the book say about Lucifer, what character he was, and what happened, basically?
Okay, so Lucifer, so I've given some of the cosmology for background, so that folks can try to get a handle on this. Now, Lucifer is in the celestial hierarchy at the level of what they call the local system. So I've mentioned briefly that you have what's known as local universe, which is up to 10 million inhabited planets, and it has a celestial administration. And then the smallest administrative unit of a local universe is known as a local system, which is up to 1,000 inhabited planets, and its angelic administration is headed up by a being of the order that Lucifer was. And I won't get into the name of that, it's a little arcane, but beings of that, celestial beings of that order, are administrators who oversee the celestial hierarchy of these planets in a local system. And there's an awful lot that goes into that, and part three of the Ranch book explains that in some detail. But in any case, these are high beings who are specially chosen and specially trained to manage millions of celestial beings who are in turn managing planets, inhabited planets. They're not just managing, they're ministering to. They're loving, their ministrations are loving. But there's other things that they do, such as in the realms of biology, for example, that we can get into. But in any case, Lucifer was at a level in the celestial hierarchy where there's a possibility that a celestial being can get the idea that there's something amiss, not amiss, but something that they can't quite see far above them, because there's this teaching that there's a central universe wherein God the Father resides, and that in his stead there's a local being, local creator beings I mentioned before, who are the creators of the local universe, and who have this huge mission to take human beings into an eternal life career so that they can ascend into the central universe. I haven't mentioned that, but that's what eternal life is supposed to be, according to the Rancher book. There's an ascension. Mm-hmm. And so these local celestials don't really see this very much. They're local. And so in very rare, one in a million cases, they can get the idea that there's some kind of control system above them. And they can begin to question it and then eventually rebel. And so Lucifer went off the rails because he began to question the administrator, what I like to call the multiverse, the higher universe administration, because he couldn't really discern what was really going on. He had to take it on faith, and he rejected that faith.
So he was unhappy with his role, basically, what he was meant to do then, in a way.
Correct, exactly, because he felt that it was kind of a waste of time to manage, not so much a waste of time, but it was not an efficient use of time to manage planets in the way they were doing it. And the way they were doing it was very, very incremental. And that is really one of the great messages of the Urantia book, which is that evolution is the supreme activity in the time space universe, but it's very slow, very incremental. In fact, you can see that when you understand that it says the physical universe is a trillion years old. That's a lot slower in its evolution than the 13.7 billion years old. So, you know, Lucifer's watching this very slow unfolding of these planets, which are his wards. And very slow evolution of life, and very slow evolution of humans over eons, and begins to think this is just an administrative superstructure that's getting its kicks, telling us what to do down here. we can do it better, and we will do it better. And he had certain prerogatives which permitted him to override what was being done from the higher realms. And so he then went around to his subject planets trying to convince the angelic hierarchy of these planets to go with his new plan, the Lucifer plan. But of those planets, there are a little bit over 600 in our local system. Only 37 went over to his side.
So the, sorry to interrupt again, but just to reiterate this point, the basics that we get of the story in mythology, and partly this is coming from the Bible, and but also interpretation and other, you know, texts as well. But the basics of that story is basically correct, and then the Urantia book is basically just is more descriptive than what we've heard before. Is that correct?
Much more, because if you look at Genesis, for example, which speaks of the just in a few lines, and I'm sure you know about this well, of the renowned men of old who went into the daughters of men and kind of created a hybrid race.
Yep.
And all of that, and the Nephilim and these giants that they speak of very briefly in the Bible. This story is the result of the Lucifer rebellion on our planet Urantia, wherein now I have to kind of go off on sort of the planetary aspect of the rebellion, if you like.
Oh, sure.
So here on our planet, every planet has a planetary chief administrator, and the chief administrator of our planet, I'm just using a generic term. The chief administrator of our planet was named Caligastia. And Caligastia was convinced by the Lucifer manifesto to go over to the dark side. And so in so doing, the whole planet administration swung over with him. And what was happening at that time was, remember earlier, Henrik, we talked about the earlier revelations that were completely lost.
Mm, yep.
So, you know, there's a lot of legends and sort of, you know, if you look at the story of the Anunnaki, deciphered from the cuneiform tablets, Sumerian cuneiform tablets, you know, by a number of people, you know, and specifically Sitchin. There is, in Sitchin's work and in other interpretations, there were these gods that descended. At some point. And in these legends, which are in Sumerian cuneiform tablets, but in many other civilizations, that these gods came down. And then there's what you might call the combat myth, that there was warfare between them. And so the Urantia book, goes on for a couple hundred pages telling you what that was. And what that was is that there was an administration of beings who had incarnated 500,000 years ago. Now, Sitchin places it about 500,000 years ago, so there's a big correlation there. And this group were beings who had been specifically designed to appear like human beings, but they were actually off-planet beings who took on bodies using the DNA from local tribes, and they constructed bodies and forms for these persons, these off-planet persons, who were kind of planetary missionaries. And there were 100 of them who incarnated 500,000 years ago an area near the Persian Gulf, near the current country of Bahrain, and created a city there which was to be the planetary capital. And there is, in archaeology, a city named Dilmun, which was a later evolution of this city. And it was here that the rebellion caused a tremendous degeneration of what had been built up there. So let me slow down here and let you ask me a question about it, because it's an elaborate story.
Very, very interesting. Now, let's backtrack a little bit here and just want to ask you again what actually Lucifer wanted to do. What did he want to speed up the process of evolution and effectively kind of take over as the head administrator of Earth or Urantia? Or what did he want to do, really?
Yeah, what he wanted to do, first of all, his manifesto said that there really is no God. There's no God. There's no deity. It was an atheist teaching. So that's a huge, huge rebellion. And secondly, that this superstructure that was controlling evolution through administrators like himself, was not skillful the way that the locals could be. It was sort of like the idea of local control of your politics, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were going to do it better. And the way we're going to do it is by not paying so much attention to the free will of human beings. That is to say, you know, the way the evolution occurs once human beings appear on a planet is that they have to freely choose things. And it might take them eons to choose certain things, unless they're specifically taught to do so. And but this is the most effective way to evolve civilizations. It's been learned in millions and millions and millions of planets who've evolved over the eons. But not according to Lucifer. According to him, it would be something more akin to what communism is compared to sort of natural capitalism, wherein, you know, the capitalist ethic, and, you know, I'm not a big fan of capitalism, but is the notion of you freely use resources to create private property and business without over control of some central administration. But communism would say, no, we can speed that up. We can centralize administration and do things more effectively and more efficiently. But that may mean we're not going to let you have your own garden plot and grow your own vegetables. You're not going to have the freedom to raise money and start a business. We're not going to let you do that because that causes chaos, not so much chaos, but it's an inefficient way to do production. So we're going to centralize production, and we're going to call the shots from above, and it's better for you.
And it's funny because when they do that, everything goes to hell as well, and nothing works after that point. So,
yeah, well, you know, you live in Europe. I traveled in Russia, and I saw some of the results of this.
Oh, and it's horrible, absolutely horrible.
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, yeah. Moscow, and I've seen you know some of this, not as much as maybe you have, but
yeah, it's rampant in Sweden, and there's a full on, you know, corporatism infused with the socialism there. So I see the tremendous detrimental effects that this type of thinking has. And it's interesting as well, because if we tie in this, then what we hear, or what I've heard anyway from the story of Lucifer and a little bit like that, is that it's a reverse of what you basically said. It was the idea is that it's God's law or God's decision that actually is steeped in order, and basically there is no free will in his universe or her universe, whatever. And it's Lucifer who comes along and kind of breaks that pattern, being the rebellion to actually offer human beings free will. But what you're saying, what you're sharing from the Urantia book, is the reverse of that.
Yeah, it's complicated, but yeah, it's actually it's like propaganda or Orwellian propaganda saying we're actually making you free, right? But there's really not freedom. It's the communist part. You know, it's Leon Trotsky is going to tell you how to run your economy, and you locals really can't figure it out. Yeah. So it's really like that. And you know, I certainly was a Marxist when I was in my early 20s, and I really understand the appeal of this, and so it's an idea that has a lot of currency on our planet. Which
unfortunately,
is,
it does. Yeah.
So certain elites, the elites know better, and let them, you know, take control of your rights, and you don't really know, you know, and so it is a set of paradoxes. In the name of freedom, they remove your freedom.
That's right. Very, very interesting. In a little while, we're going to take a break here, but we want to talk a little bit more about basically where people can go to find the texts and find the updated versions of all of this. As far as I've figured out so far, of course, the Urantia book is available on many different websites. So why don't we cover this a little bit? Are there different versions out there now? Where is there original one and you know, translations, updated ones? What's your take on this? Because it is kind of a mess, isn't it, out there right now?
No, I don't think it's all that bad. There's really just two big publishers. There's the Urantia Foundation, the original copyright holder, and they do a great job of publishing the book. They have done a superb job of getting translations done. And I mentioned previously there is a Swedish translation, even though Sweden is a totally secular country, probably not a huge market, but most of the European languages are done. Even things like Lithuanian, Russian, Greek is nearly done, but all the main European languages are done. But no, you can easily get it in books, at least in the States, you can get it in bookstores, but it's easily available in European translations in European bookstores, as far as I know. And there's a Chinese translation, it's some years away. Japanese is not too far from, Arabic is actually in process, Hindi. It's widely available. It's not really an issue getting the Ranch book. Also, you can download ebook versions, and a lot of people are putting out free ebook versions of it now. There's hundreds of thousands of people downloaded the ebook of the Ranch book in recent years.
Excellent. Let's talk about your website a little bit as well, and some of the updated versions that you have out there, and anything else. I mean, as you said, you're a publisher, you have a lot of different titles out there. Please go ahead and mention a few of these so people know where to go to find out more about you and your work as well.
Thanks, Henrik. My main site is evolving-souls.org. There's a hyphen in there, evolving souls with a hyphen.org. And there I have the five books that we have published that are secondary works about the Rancher book. My specialty is in publishing the supplemental materials, which are these new transmissions from the same teachers. It's controversial stuff, but I think people will find it a very good way to access the spirit of the Arantia book, including my brand new book, which is called The Adventure of Being Human, which is featured there. And those are advanced teachings, spiritual teachings, based on the Arantia revelation.
There's a lot to talk about, a lot of material here, of course, and we'll get to it as much as we can. We're going to continue, of course, and primarily talk about the Arantia book. But if we have time later, we might talk a little bit about some of these updates and, of course, some of your other books as well. But let's take a short break here at this point. The websites are going to be linked up on redicecreations.com, evolving-souls.org, and originpress.org for you as well. So you can click through easily from there. But we'll take a short break at this point, and we'll be right back with Byron Belitzos.